that his microphone is on, so everyone can hear what he's saying. So it's my pleasure to introduce you to our next panel now, which is that Israeli perspective. We have an extremely distinguished panel, and I'm handing over to our third Atkin fellow that I want to introduce to you, Sefi Kedmi. You can read more about him in your folder, but Sefi will moderate this. Thanks for returning after the lunch, and over to you, Sefi.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for being here. First, I want to thank Celia and Edward Etkin and the ICSR for enabling me to take part in this and generally in the program. It's been a tremendous privilege, and I hope it succeeds in the future. Today with us, we're going to discuss the Israeli perspectives of the Middle Eastern conflict and future prospects of negotiations. First, our panelists. Some of you know them, and some of you don't. So, His Excellency, the Israeli Ambassador to the United Kingdom, Mr. Ron Prosor, has distinguished us in his presence. Dr. Aaron Bregman from KCL, King's College. Dr. Eli Carmon, right over there, and Dr. Ron Funder. Basically, this discussion is supposed to revolve around the different issues within Israel regarding the conflict and what are the future prospects. Without further ado, I would like to first regard a question to Dr. Aaron Bregman. He's a lecturer at KCL in the War Studies Department. He's the author of many books about the Middle East and companion to the BBC and PBS documentaries made in that regard. Dr. Bregman, regarding negotiations, there are very different opinions of whether or not we should go and start negotiations right now and get some sort of a shelf agreement in the type of that was tried to be accepted in the Annapolis process and that was lately almost agreed upon between Prime Minister Olmert and President Abbas. And basically, that was slightly rejected at the end. Or that we should refrain and wait until the time becomes better and more ripe for negotiations. And how do you deal with the problems that a unified government from the Palestinian side of Hamas and its position and call for destruction of Israel, how do you deal from the Israeli perspective with needing to deal with that? Because basically it's pretty hard to come to terms with somebody who calls for your annihilation.
Well, we have a... Can you hear me? Well, we know exactly what's going to be the end result of negotiations. Israel will withdraw from 92% of the West Bank. Israel will keep about 650 square kilometers from the West Bank, where the big blocks of settlements, or where 80% of the settlers live, and will compensate the Palestinians. There will be a bridge or tunnel connecting the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. And Jerusalem will be divided between the two parties, and there will be a satisfactory solution to the Palestinian refugee problem, whereby out of the 5 or 6 million Palestinian refugees, 10,000 will return to Israel over a period of 10 to 12 years. In terms of Israel and Syria, Israel withdrew from the Golan Heights. The only matter to be resolved now, how wide will be the strip along the northern side of the Sea of Galilee? And these are the solutions. What do we need? We need an Israeli Churchill and an Arab Churchill, which could lead the people and implement these two issues. So that's it. Nothing to talk about. Having said that, time is very short. If Iran becomes nuclear, and I believe that Ron will probably talk about it, then this will be the end of the peace process in the Middle East, because no Israeli Prime Minister, left or right, will be able to convince the Israeli people to give up land in the Middle East, which seems to be more dangerous. So time is short. About Hamas and the PLO and the disagreements, nothing new about it. You always have disagreements among different factions related to statehood. The Jews in Palestine, before the State of Israel, before the State of Israel was established, had the Haganah, the Irgun, the Stern Gang, or the Lehi. And there are disagreements. The Palestinians eventually agree with each other, and they will work together. In my opinion, the way forward now is not to do what President Obama is trying to do, which is wasting time, negotiating with the Israelis how many settlements should be there on the West Bank, but he should give a big push to an attempt to sort out the Israeli-Syrian conflict, which is easier to solve and sort out because it is a border dispute, and the current prime minister, his predecessor, and all Israeli prime ministers, 1993 to now, were willing to give back the Golan Heights. So all they have to do is to sort this difference between what the Syrians want to have, namely the 4th of June 1967 line, with the future line between the two countries, or the Israeli view, which is to have the border running a few hundred meters to the east of it. So all problems are solved in 5 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Pundak is the president of the Paris Center for Peace since 2001. He was part of the Israeli negotiation team for the Oslo Accords from 1993 and involved in many Track 2 initiatives. Dr. Pundak, it has been known to say that only the right wing in Israel is capable of making peace. And currently we are in a basically right-wing government with a hint of left from the Labour Party, where you have a very weird situation where Kadima, the center party that insisted on the government accepting the two-state solution, is out. And the prime minister saying officially this week that Israel's stance is with the two-state solution. How do you regard this situation? And what do you see a way out of this situation, and maybe involving Kadima vis-a-vis the political situation in Israel?
First of all, it's true that in 1977 it was Menachem Begin who signed the agreement with the Egyptians, but nevertheless other two important agreements were negotiated and signed by Labour-led government, namely the 1993 Oslo and 1994 with Jordan, both of them under the leadership of Yitzhak Rabin, the late Yitzhak Rabin. So I think that it's not only the right wing. It depends who is the prime minister and who is the leader. I presume that Ehud Olmert, in his last tenure, if things would have gone differently, I presume that he was able both to sign an agreement with Syria and with the Palestinians, and also to convince the Israeli people to accept it. So I think it's more a matter of who is the leader and who takes the risk. I think that by and large the Israeli people is ripe for an agreement both with the Palestinians as well as with the Syrians, although polls, interestingly enough, are saying that the majority of Israelis are against relinquishing the Golan Heights for peace. However, they are in favor of withdrawal from the West Bank and East Jerusalem, Arab East Jerusalem, for peace. So it's a matter of leadership and matter of ideology and decisions. I am afraid that the current government, you say hint of left with Labour, I can hardly recognize the hint or the Labour. I mean, I would even say that this kind of fig leaf is bad for the peace process. So I think that by and large is a government which is being led by the policy of Benjamin Netanyahu. Truly, his last declaration at the Bar-Ilan speech surprised many. I wasn't surprised. I know for quite a long time that he speaks about the idea of two states. But the two states that he speaks about is not the two states which can lead us to be able to agree upon an end game which will bring peace to the Middle East, because I think that his maximum will not meet the Palestinian minimum. And we have seen already in Camp David 2 in 2000, July 2000, when the then Prime Minister Ehud Barak came with a proposal which was undoubtedly, more than what Netanyahu speaks or I believe imagined today. And even this proposal was short of the ability of allowing us to reach peace, because he even did not suggest what Ronnie just mentioned regarding the territory. I will, by the way, argue that the solution is not 92%, but the solution is closer to the Geneva Initiative, which was, I must admit, I was one of its drafters and the one of those who delineated the border between us and the Palestinians, both in the Geneva Initiative as well as the Abu Mazen Bailey Initiative. In the Abu Mazen Bailey Initiative, as a remark, we were drawing a map of around 4.5% exchange of territories, and in the Geneva we spoke about something like 2.5-3%. So I presume it will be more at the sort of 4-4%, and it's enough for the Israeli needs in order to have an agreement. Going back to the issue of the current government, I cannot see Netanyahu sitting with Abu Mazen and negotiating seriously, wholeheartedly, an agreement which is what we know is an agreement as was described here, partition of Jerusalem, etc., etc. I mean, again, we know the outline. We all know, by and large, the outline of an agreement which, interestingly enough, is accepted today for a long time by the majority of Israelis and by the majority of Palestinians. By the way, I believe also the majority of those who voted for Hamas will at the end of the day will say yes to an agreement like this. So maybe Rak HaLikud Yachol, maybe it's only the Likud party can, but what they can is not bring peace between us and the Palestinians. Having said this, I think that they may surprise us with an agreement with the Syrians. I think that a possible outlet for the Netanyahu government is to do everything on the ground in order to quiet the issue of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, whether by what he calls economic peace, or whether other activities in order to smooth things versus the Palestinians, and then against his will maybe, against his declaration definitely, against maybe the majority of Israelis today, he can carry us into an agreement which is similar to what Barak offered to the Syrians, by and large, similar to what Rabin offered, again by and large, similar to what Netanyahu offered with the Ron Lauder initiative when he was prime minister between 1996 and 1999, and surprise us with an agreement that from his point of view will serve the similar purposes of what Menachem Begin did in 77. One of the reasons for the agreement with Egypt, which I think was historical, important, probably beyond what Menachem Begin thought, was that what he hoped that by giving up Sinai Desert for peace with the Egyptians, he will allow actually a fait accompli and the continuation of changing realities on the ground in the West Bank, because God forbid he didn't want to do anything seriously beyond the autonomy plan in the West Bank, and I presume that Netanyahu is not far away. So the good news is maybe something will happen. The bad news is that if nothing will happen on the Palestinian side, which I think is the cornerstone for any peace agreement, including peace between Israel and Iran, by the way, I'm not so afraid from the Iranians. I mean, unlike probably 99.9 Israeli, I'm not afraid from the Iranians, and I think that the way to solve the Israeli-Iranian problem is through an agreement with the Palestinians, namely, and mainly, the agreement on East Jerusalem and the holy places for Islam.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kondak. Dr. Carmon, he's a researcher in the ICT, the Institute for Counterterrorism in the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya, which, by the way, that's where I come from, and a lecturer on terrorism. He's advisor to the Ministry of Defense and was involved in NATO workshops and the Israeli Atlantic Forum. Dr. Carmon, especially after the words of Dr. Pundak, in regards to the settlements and other obstacles in light of the Bar-Ilan speech and clear stance of the new American administration in regard to expansion of settlements. How do you see the settlements and that issue in light of negotiations, and do you think that the current Israeli government can and should stop the expansion of negotiations in its political capacity nowadays? Thank you.
I'm very worried in trying to solve the complex issues of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in 5 minutes, especially at this hour, where I say when I'm teaching my students that it's very difficult 2 o'clock after lunch to fight terrorism. But I tried to make some comments on these very, very complex issues, and unfortunately I'm not agreeing with the optimism of my colleague and friend, Ron Pundak. We have here a regional, and I would say even global situation, in which the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is only one of the problems. And surely the issue of the settlements, which I opposed since the beginning, I must tell you that I didn't visit Nablus since 1972, and I know Hebron only from the helicopter. But this does not mean that the issue of the settlements is the only and the most important issue. And I agree with Ron on the fact that the Israeli people, if they will be convinced that there is a good solution for the conflict, they will accept that most of the settlements will be withdrawn, and even part of the settlers themselves, because not all of them are religious fanatics. I'll give some examples of the complexities. Okay, first of all, we have on the Palestinian issue, if you want the chasm, perhaps between Fatah and Hamas. We heard lately that Hamas was preparing to assassinate probably Abu Mazen or Saeed Fayyad, the prime minister. And we know already they did assassinate hundreds of Fatah members in the Gaza Strip. But I'd like to cite from a Fatah leader, Dahlan, Mohamed Dahlan, which was responsible for Gaza until they lost it to Hamas. He says in March this year, "I want to say for the thousandth time in my own name and the name of all my fellow members of the Fatah movement, we do not demand that the Hamas movement recognize Israel. On the contrary, we demand of the Hamas movement not to recognize Israel, because the Fatah movement does not recognize Israel even today." And if you look to the Fatah covenant today in English on the website, you see the same thing. They don't recognize Israel. So I don't see exactly how the Fatah movement, first of all, mend the fences with the Hamas, which is much, much more, radical. It took to the PLO 17 years, from 74 to 1991, Madrid conference, to try to change the stance. I ask myself how much time it would take to the Hamas, which is a religious political movement, to change its covenant and to accept the existence of Israel, especially when we have part of the Hamas, of the Fatah, which does not recognize Israel. And by the way, I don't know how many people here know that the Secretary General of Fatah is not Abu Mazen. The Secretary General of Fatah is Farouk Kaddoumi, which stays in Tunis and Damascus. And he is negotiating with Hamas, not with the Israelis. And so this is a very complex situation on the Palestinian side. On the Israeli side, we have a political system which does not permit a strong government to subsist and to take very difficult decisions. And the Netanyahu government is not able, in my opinion, on the background of this situation, to take this tough decision. Moreover, I think that the key to the last events in the last, if you want, 10 years perhaps, the key to the developments in the area is the advance of the radical Islamist states and movements. It began even before that, but the Iranian nuclear issue and the Iranian involvement through Hezbollah, through Syria, through Hamas, in the sabotaging the peace process, since the beginning of Madrid process. Since the Madrid process, there was a Tehran conference in the October 91, whose decision was to sabotage at any price, the peace process, and they did it. They did it because every time there was any hope of a negotiation with success, including the Oslo Agreement in 94-95, after the signing of the agreement, it was sabotage of terrorism. And they try to do it all day, all night, if they can do it. This is an issue which does not involve only Israel. It involves the United States, it involves the European Union, it involves practically all the Arab states, especially moderate states. I want to refer to what was said in the previous panel about the United States' new administration, the Obama administration. I think indeed there is a change. There is a change in style, which is very important, in language, which is very important. I'm not sure about the change in strategy, how it will challenge the real threat of the radicals. In this sense, if we look to the radical camp, they achieved huge successes. They almost conquered Lebanon, they conquered Gaza, they had a huge, they have a huge influence in Iraq through the Shias, Iran is on the point to become nuclear. The Obama administration promised to teach or to deal with this issue through negotiation, but they have a very short time, and this is the problem. The timetable or the time framework for the resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is years, 2-3 years at least. The timetable of the nuclear project is perhaps 1 year. How do you solve it? And about the shelf agreements, I don't believe that shelf agreements can lead to any way. Because if you have a shelf agreement, the other partner, be it the unity government, Fatah Hamas, or the Hamas government in Gaza, will do everything to sabotage it and not to accept it. So what is the Olmert plan that was proposed to Abu Mazen? And Abu Mazen did not accept it. We don't accept it, at least what Abu Mazen or Arikat, Saeb Arikat said. This is the kind of plan which is on the paper and which the players, I mean the Hamas especially, and those who don't accept it, will do everything to sabotage it. So in my opinion, the only possibility is that the radio camp will be challenged on a short period and the trend of radicalization will be stopped. And in this, I think Obama made several steps. A very important step was the agreement with the Russians and the continuation of the agreement with the Russians, because the Russians are the only element in my evaluation that can press really together the United States and Europe, the Iranians specifically, to stop the nuclear program. There is no other power that can do it, and I don't have time to explain why I have this evaluation.
Thank you.
The second is, sorry, two more minutes. The second.
No, we're limited to 5 minutes per person.
There are three very new developments which give some hope that this trend of radicalization begins to be stopped. One are the elections in Lebanon, which the Hezbollah could not take power, although it was evaluated that they are very close to do it. The second is the Iranian election, and I agree with Jonathan Paris that this is a very important event, which is perhaps not in the next months, but in the next years will have a huge influence on events in the region. And the third, although people do not speak much about it, is what happens in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Because for the first time in the last years, when Al-Qaeda disappeared practically from the Middle East, it was defeated in Iraq and Saudi Arabia and in Egypt, but they returned to their land in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And the radicalization in Pakistan was on the point to take even perhaps power to conquer Islamabad. The Pakistani army for the first time is fighting very seriously the radicals, and this is the first good sign perhaps the radicalization from this region, which influenced 9/11, which influenced what happened with Al-Qaeda in Iraq and in Saudi Arabia. Perhaps this is a...
We're not trying to solve all global issues, mainly we have our own problems. Okay. Our next speaker is His Excellency Ambassador Ron Prosor. He's the Israeli ambassador to the United Kingdom since 2007. He's been involved in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs since 1986, former Director General of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and has served in numerous positions in the office. Your Excellency, Prime Minister Netanyahu gave a very important speech in Bar-Ilan University a few days ago, or a few weeks ago. And there seems to be some conflicts between things he spoke about, like the unity of Jerusalem and the settlements and the need for the recognition of the Jewish state from the other, from our partners, these demands don't really fall with the Palestinian state, with an independent Palestinian state, especially vis-a-vis the issue of Jerusalem, because as mentioned earlier on, the maximum he offered would probably not be the minimum needed to appease the other side, especially in light of the fact that the Arab Peace Initiative or the Saudi Peace Initiative, the stance of Israel in that regard is not very, very clear. How do you see us moving beyond this current situation in light of the Arab Peace Initiative and Mr. Netanyahu's remarks? Thank you.
Thank you. Look, the intense scrutiny in Israel and the interest in Israel's policy is flattering, and you know, Bibi Netanyahu's speech especially, I want to thank you for that. But you asked the question, what, from my perspective, would really be the biggest difference at this point to moving the peace process forward? And I think my answer to that is exactly what is neglected for a very long time. That is that we need the Arab world, I won't use the word moderate Arab world, to really go and pull up their sleeves and do something substantial. Now, what do we see? We see basically a situation where, in the image of an old-fashioned, I would say, boarding school headmaster, which calls Israel in with a ruler in the hand and says, looks at us in the eye and says, look, it hurts me much more than it would hurt you. And the problem is that this tough love should be divided to a wonderful set of players that without them we would not be able to achieve peace. And I'm saying it because, first of all, there are three Rons on this panel, so I hope when you present the questions you get the right Ron here. And Ron in Hebrew means happiness. I'm not sure I will be contributing to happiness in my analysis at this stage. But let's zoom out for a second. Everyone in this room, and I see Mark Ott here, and people who really dealt with those negotiations, let's zoom out and say, when was the last time any one of you heard a policy speech by Mahmoud Abbas, by Bashar Assad, by Hosni Mubarak, by the Abdallahs, both in Jordan and Saudi Arabia? When was the time you scrutinized a vision in the Arab world? What do we want? Where do we want to go? I know that the silence here is not surprising. It's not surprising for you because there is an element in this. And when Ronnie on my right, should be on my left, politically, but Ronnie sitting on my right, basically saying, we know what the solution is. Wrong, ladies and gentlemen, absolutely wrong. We might think that we know in this room what the parameters of the solutions are. Oh, but they're very, very far away from what others in the region think. And when I say zoom out for a second, even the Saudi plan that I had the option of analyzing left and right, and we will do it in a second, Saudi plan was Abdallah talking to Tom Friedman, Tom Friedman writing, and Abdallah saying, did you ever hear Abdallah articulating anything, saying anything? But what we know is that in this classroom, okay, we are called into the headmaster, the others are not even asked to present a paper while they're running around, you know, playing around in the play garden. And I think that presenting papers is very nice, but to call the Arab world to really contribute on something which is without them we won't be able to do. Why? Because it's all very nice to see, you know, the Saudis and the Kuwaitis, you know, sitting on the balcony like Waldorf and Stadler in the Muppet Show and shouting, it's a lousy show. That's very nice. Can't they contribute a bit in the question of money? Mark Otter's running for years. The Palestinian Authority receives from the European Union, from London, from Paris, from Germany, from Oslo, from Denmark, millions of dollars. Where the others, the brothers, who are so concerned in the region, are saturated in petrodollars, and no one basically says, gentlemen, do something. Yes, there are pledges. Pledges, look, ask Fayyad, he will tell you. Amazing pledges. It just doesn't come to where it needs to come. Why are they important? It's not that I'm using it for polemics, because the core issues in the solution are the question of refugees, and I want to make something clear, no Israeli government, and it doesn't make a difference where it is. It's the question, it's so illogical that the repetition of it, we want, what are the Palestinians saying? We want a independent Palestinian state, but we want our people to come to the Jewish state. Again, because probably it's my lack of understanding again, we want an independent Palestinian state, we want our people to come to the Jewish state. The answer is no. What parts of the word no don't you understand? The N or the O? No. How can you solve it? With money. You can solve it with money. Who has money? Yes. So it's relevant in the core issues. Now let's go into details. Let's not go into details because I don't have time. Let's take the question of Jerusalem. Both Saudi Arabia and the King of Morocco are very relevant in the helping, with the heavy lifting for the Palestinians to do the relevant compromises that we have not even heard yet. We have heard it in different quiet circles. But articulating it, and when I say articulating it, we deal with regimes in the region that are clearly looking to stabilize the region. And you look at Mubarak, you look at Abdullah, you look at Abdullah from Saudi Arabia, but they are dealing with political elites which are radical to the core. They don't have the legitimacy of the democratic structures by voting or democracy or other issues. The legitimacy comes from the elites which are radical in all the relevant elements that we're talking about. We need to help them in order to move those elites in the right direction. Without that, it will be left for us to exchange papers and not really reach a solution. I want to just one thing on both the Syrian and the Palestinian track. There's something that I learned from some of my dealings during the years. I think we in Israel, and not only in Israel, have to focus on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. This is the core issue. It is the most problematic issue, and we should not move to other avenues or channels, although the analysis that those things might come are very true. So the bottom line here, from my point of view, is let's conduct a situation where we ask at least and not be condescending towards, that's how I see it, towards parts of the Arab world that can really substantially contribute to achieving peace in the region. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador Prosser. And an interesting position indeed. And I guess our panelists have some things to say in that remark, or? Yeah? Okay.
Just a few comments. First of all, regarding Hamas and Fatah and recognition in Israel, etc., one should understand that we are not negotiating with parties. Like, I'm not expecting that Lieberman's party will recognize whatever. Nobody demands from a party to recognize what government signs. What we should demand is from governments that we are negotiating with. And on the Palestinian side, we are not negotiating, by the way, even with the government. We are negotiating with the PLO. The PLO, since Oslo, is our partner for negotiations on final status. So similarly, that we have never asked the Likud to say that two banks for the Jordan, which has always been their ideology, they should omit it from their ideology or from the papers or from the maps on the doors of the museums to allow Prime Minister Rabin to sign peace with the Jordanians, etc., etc. So if ever there will be a unity government on the Palestinian side, the issues that are on the table should be versus the government, and the government should recognize what the Quartet and what the European demanded, the three conditions. But Hamas, Fatah, these are parties. I'm not dialoguing with parties, and I don't care, actually, what is written in their platforms. What I do care is that the official partner that I'm sitting with and negotiating with will accept what is or what are the conditions for negotiation. So I mean, it's easy to go and, you know, dig and say Lieberman in his campaign said something about the Palestinians now, unless he will not revoke it, he cannot come to England and speak with, I don't know, the British Parliament. Let's look at the future. Let's be positive in our approach and not trying to look always into the past and say, in South Africa, Arafat said something about Hudaybiyah and this and that and the other. Again, it's easy always to cut processes and kill them. It's more difficult to move onward, and I think that at the end of the day, it's our mutual interest to move forward. Now, I must admit that as much as I feel friend of Ron Poisson, of Ambassador Poisson, I am not happy, I must admit, to listen to this line, which I think is a bit the line of the government. And knowing Ron, and I hope I'm not going now to cut his wonderful career, that it will be a different government, he speak differently. But let's put it aside, because I can, Ron, I can show you Abu Mazen's platform ten times, and I can give you speeches by King Abdullah from Jordan about his vision 20 times, which are, by the way, papers and that he wrote and speeches that he gave, which are incredible, intelligent, and visionary. So what? Does anybody in Israel listen to it, respond to it? And does Netanyahu's speech in Bar-Ilan is such a visionary speech? I mean, the fact that he uttered the two words Palestinian state, so what? But again, I don't think that this is really the matter. The matter is, are we looking forward? Do we understand that it's an Israel interest, first and foremost an Israeli interest, as an Israeli I'm saying it, let alone a Palestinian interest, to move forward, to leave the West Bank, to understand that settlements are not only against the international law, which is relevant, but it's irrelevant with our discussion, but it's bad for Israel at the end of the day. And we need to hear our government saying something at this issue. Now, I know that I'm sounding a bit critical or very critical about our government. I would like to emphasize, and specifically here towards an English audience, and I heard it from many, you know, following what is happening in the academia, newspapers, etc. One should not be mistaken. The people like us who are criticizing our government, I mean, we are the strongest Zionists that one can think about. Meaning that our criticism doesn't come from the fact that we think that what we are doing as a nation is wrong. We are criticizing our government, this government, or that government. I criticized all governments since Oslo, including Rabin, Peres, Netanyahu, and Barak, and everybody, because I think all of them made mistakes. And I criticized all Palestinian governments since Oslo, because I think all Palestinian governments and leadership since Arafat, and obviously Arafat, but not only, also sometimes Abu Mazen and Fayyad did mistakes. And whenever a government or a leader does a mistake, we should, both Arabs and Israelis and Europeans, criticize them. But this doesn't mean that Israel's legitimacy should be put in question, or that what we are doing should put any questions about our existence, etc., etc. I'm saying it here loud and clear towards British audience. And last but not least is the issue of the people. And I'm coming, you know, from the school of mind, and I'm also involved in activities which are combining the top-down and the bottom-up approach. And I think that we must remember that at the end of the day, we're also speaking about individuals, about people, about communities. And what we need to see is a dialogue also among the people, not only the Israeli and Palestinian people, but also the Israeli and Arab people. And here, I definitely adhere to what Ron says, because he didn't mention it, Ron Posso, but he definitely also meant. What we are lacking is dialogue with the Egyptian intelligentsia. What we are lacking, where's my dear friend from Jordan, we are lacking a dialogue with the Jordanian intelligentsia. What we are lacking is dialogue with the Saudi intelligentsia, and not only intelligentsia, but also the politicians, some of them not so intelligent on both sides, as well as the merchants, as well as the academicians, as well as the artists, etc., etc. And I will finalize by saying that when we are doing it, what we find again and again is that it takes no time for both sides to say, guys, actually, as Ronnie said, the answers are there. It's possible to do it. And I personally believe that eventually we'll do it.
A very short one. I am disagreeing with my friend Ambassador Ron Posso again. The Saudi initiative was on television, and we can listen to each and every word. And I suspect that it's already on YouTube. You can go there. 26th of March, 2002 was the date, as far as I remember. Having said that, the Saudi initiative is a framework. You would still have to negotiate everything. Right of return, Jerusalem, borders, etc. But in response to what my friend M on the left, which should be on my right, said, but this is a job, you know, I respect it. The Saudis were very, very clear about their policy. And I invite you all to read the speech of the Saudis, and again, it's on television.
After defining my job on both sides, two ones, you know, always an Israeli ambassador, when he addresses an audience, the worst thing that can happen to him is that someone tells him, it's a friend of the state of Israel. When that sentence begins, I know, oh, they, what comes afterwards. The issue is, there was a certain paradigm. And this paradigm didn't work. Something in this paradigm did not work. And the question is why. And both Rons, and I'll put you in one hat for a second, basically saying, let's continue. You know what, let's drive on. As if nothing on the left or the right has really changed, and with our motivation, inspiration, we can do it alone. And I'm saying, no, we cannot. We cannot do it alone. There has to be, on the other side, much more that is going to be done in order to help us achieve peace. And if we won't have that, I know it's not nice not to sound optimistic. We won't be able to move forward because the challenges are very problematic. And one more sentence. You know, Charles Dickens in the Tale of Two Cities talked about it was the best of times and it was the worst of times. And I think about being it the worst of times, I alluded a bit to it, but I want to also add the Iranian issue. And I want to add the Iranian issue because the Iranian issue allows us to maybe make it the best of times, because for the first time, you have mutual interests between some Arab states and the state of Israel, because they understand that the threat from Iran is not just on the hegemonial issue, but it pertains to the main survivability of regimes like Egypt, like Saudi Arabia, like the Gulfies and Jordan. And that threat that is tightening around their necks, I think is pushing them to do things that they were not able to do or were not willing to do in the past. So it might be the best of times, but we have to use this opportunity and not just let it go. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador. Professor, very quick comment from Dr. Cremon, and then we'll open up.
Two comments. One about the declarations of political movements. Hamas is still a movement, and Fatah is a movement. Arafat, a friend that signed the Oslo agreements, promised, pledged not to use violence. And in September 2000, he took his Fatah forces, the Tanzim and the Al-Aqsa brigades, and killed, assassinated hundreds of Israelis, and provoked the hundreds of thousands of Palestinian killed people. So the movement behind the PLO is Fatah. This is the truth, and not the PLO is not something abstract. About the Arab initiative, I think the Saudi initiative was much more favorable, or much more easier for Israel to discuss. But what happened the same March 2002, when it was discussed and approved as Arab initiative in Beirut, it was Syria and Lebanon and the influence of Syria that changed the wording. And the same night, people do not know, the same night, it was the Pesach Easter night when the Hamas organized the biggest suicide bombing in a hotel in Netanya in Israel. 2 hours after this attack, where 30 Israelis were assassinated, which provoked the defensive shield operation and the reoccupation of the Gaza of the West Bank. 2 hours after this attack, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, the leader of Hamas, appears on TV and says, this is not to kill Jews. This is a message to the Arab leaders in Beirut, which have to decide on the Arab initiative. This is our message. So you understand what is the Hamas position vis-a-vis the Arab initiative.
I must tell you a short story, I'm sorry. I mean,
I think everybody...
It's an ugly story, but I'll tell you. The guy who actually committed this bomb exploded and killed himself. But the one who sent him was caught by the Israeli army, like most of them. And he confessed, actually, that he sent the guy to explode in Netanya, and he directed him to the market. And he said, I'm expecting that will be a small explosion. Another one, as he says, a small one, only 5 Israelis to be killed. For us, every murder is a tragedy. But now I'm quoting him. Now, this was Passover. There was nobody at the market. So the guy, and now we are portraying it here as if it was planned, and Yassin sends a message, you know, a master plan of the sophisticated Hamas. He was searching for another place, and he was looking, and then he remembered that once he was working in an hotel. So he went to this hotel. Unfortunately, in this hotel, there was a big event of Seder. Many people were there. He entered there. By the way, disguised, like, I don't know whether a woman or a rabbi or whatever, but he went in disguise, as a woman. And he entered there, it was crowded, the doors were closed, he blowed himself up, and here suddenly we have a strategical attack. And suddenly this strategical attack, which was not planned, is bringing Sheikh Ahmed Yassin to say this is something, and brings Israel to enter and reoccupy the West Bank. I just would like to end by this guy, this terrible man who sent it. And he said, I opened the radio and I heard at the beginning there was a bomb, I was happy. And then I heard that 5 people were killed, I was very happy. And then it was, you know, 10 people, 15 people, etc. And I said, oh God, what did I do? Now, I'm not telling the story in order that we feel pity for this bastard. Don't feel pity for this bastard. Let's hope that he'll be in jail for the rest of his life. But I just want to tell you, and I'm as a historian who wrote PhD in birth history, it's not always, you know, calculated, pre-planned, master planned. Hamas thinks this, Assad thinks that, etc. At the end of the day, these are small things which eventually are provoking whoever to do things which sometimes are right and sometimes are wrong.
To complete, to complete the picture.
No, but we have to. Sorry. This would be the end.
No, this is very important.
I know, but this is even more important because
there was
a
second.
I am sorry.
There was a second suicide bomber.
No.
With 20 kilos.
No. Okay. Everybody understands the situation. It's not very good, but we do have to continue. Okay. Thank you. Now we will follow. Yes. Yes. Okay. Well, please, like to start taking questions. The gentleman in the front.
Three quick ones. Ron Prosser, you mentioned Tom Friedman's article about what Abdullah said. Well, in fact, Abdullah said the same thing a year and a half before at a delegation that I attended in Jeddah. This is the Saudi Crown Prince at the time. I was with Henry Sigmund's U.S. Middle East project. And what he said was, for us, Israel is no longer a taboo, a political taboo. You have a political conflict, solve it. It is not a problem for us on a religious basis. He said this a year before. I agree with you. There is a problem that when you try to print that in the International Herald Tribune, they seize all the papers in Saudi Arabia in English. So they don't want the word out. But he did say that to us privately. Ellie, I have a question for you. You know, one of the things that many people have noticed since Nasser, really, is the decline of the Arab world relative to Turkey, Iran, and Israel. Should Israel make peace with an Iran that's different from the present Iran, an Iran without the current regime? It might be enticing for Israel to go in that route rather than to pursue peace with Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the others. And my final point is, Ron, again, Ambassador, the Palestinians are not the only ones who come up empty from the pledges, from the Gulfs. Our friends, the Pakistanis, have been begging for the last year for their pledges to be paid by the Gulf, and they're the ones who haven't paid up on their pledges, the Pakistanis.
Just state your name and where you're from.
I'm Jonathan Paris. I'm an associate fellow at the ICSR.
Thank you. One more question, and
Khalid Nadeem, South Asian Middle East Forum. First of all, it was very refreshing to hear Ron Pundit. I thought you were very fair as an Israeli saying what you said, and you're the most neutral person on the platform. I was very disappointed with the ambassador, not surprisingly, with some of the things he said.
Let's focus on questions, not...
Yeah, I'm going to give a question. I'm going to give a question for the ambassador. Before the peace process goes forward, Ambassador, I believe you have a great problem to solve around the settlements. Can you give us a definitive answer about what the Israeli government is going to do about the settlements? Are you going to stop them? Are you going to remove people? Have you a definite go-ahead on this? And also, is there any possibility of you doing something about this separation barrier, which I saw when I visited the region, which I think really breaks relationships between Israelis and Palestinians? Even though I know it's a security.
Thank you. We'll have short answers. Please answer shortly. And one question each, okay?
So. Yes. Sorry for disappointing you. I know honesty and realism is sometimes wakes people up. But on the question of settlements, first of all, the whole issue of settlements is always wonderful. Settlements are the main hurdle to peace. You probably believe that. Israel substantiated something. It's not theory now. We went out of Gaza completely, and not just of Gaza completely. We took out four settlements in the West Bank, hence showing a political horizon for the Palestinians. The Olmert government that was voted out a couple of months ago was voted on a platform to unilaterally withdraw out of the West Bank. The Israeli people gave the Olmert government a green light to continue in unilaterally withdrawal out of the West Bank. So the issue of the settlements as the major hurdle or block, Israel showed that by doing that, we gave an opportunity, a chance for the Palestinians without roadblocks, without settlements, to really do something with it, to change the equation. And like I said, with the four settlements, also the political horizon. As you know, things turned out completely different. So the Israeli public, I think rightly so, is quite skeptical. Now, to answer directly on the question of settlements, this government has clearly said that it would freeze settlements. The discussion that is taking place with Michelos is on the natural growth issue. The natural growth issue, I won't go into the details now, but there's a clear talks now with the United States what was agreed and what was not agreed. But the Netanyahu government clearly said a freeze on settlements. And knowing what is happening in Israel now, and you can hear the voices, that policy is beginning to be implemented. So, and also to be fair on this, when Israel talks about settlements, it excludes the issue of Jerusalem that we see as something that will be dealt with on the final status between both sides. On the question of the security, I completely believe that without the security fence, we wouldn't be able to move an inch in the peace process. Did we think that we want to spend so much money on a fence? No. Do we have something else that we can do with it? Yes. Did someone decide one day that this is something that we have to do because we want to create problems for the Palestinians or for us? The answer is no. There was clearly a reason for the security fence to be erected. And surprisingly, every place that you have the fence until now, there's a clear decrease in the amount of terrorist activities over the fence. Is it something that it's obvious to every Israeli that when we reach peace we'll have to come down? Yes. Is it uncomfortable? Yes. Does it protect lives? The answer is yes, too. So under that calibration, it's something which is necessary for us to be able to bridge the interim time. Thank you.
Can I have it very quickly?
Very quickly.
The natural growth mentioned by the ambassador is an old Israeli trick to continue and build settlements. Having said that, I think that it is absolutely wrong now, and this is what Obama is trying to do, is to negotiate with the Israelis about this issue now. It's a big mistake because he is losing momentum. He should leave it. He should push the big, big story, either Syria or a conference somewhere here, King's College, wherever, between Israelis and Palestinians. Don't waste your time. You'll be so exhausted after weeks and months of negotiations with Israelis and Palestinians that you will lose all your momentum. Wrong, wrong, wrong.
Okay. I'm all in the front.
Thank you. My question to the ambassador, I believe that the Israeli discourse regarding the recognition of Israel has been changed. Because since, you know, just like I have been hearing that Israel is requesting a recognition of Israel or a recognition of the state of Israel. Now there you are talking about the recognition of Israel as a Jewish state. This might mean that tomorrow you will need, if you want to have a peace agreement with Syria, you need to recognize Syria as an Alawi state, or probably you need to recognize Palestine as a Muslim state, or to recognize whatever as a Sunni state. So this means that we are going to nominate states based on faith and religion, not based on politics or ideology.
Thank you.
the lady in the back.
Ahlam Akram. First of all, I'd like to thank Mr. Bundak, really. You really, it's time that we stand together and really acknowledge where there were mistakes and move forward. Without that, we cannot achieve any peace. What I think at the moment, and I think all of you gentlemen and most of the people in the audience knows the fact that Netanyahu have no intention whatsoever in moving anything, and basically what he is trying, his policy, is to manage the conflict. Now, the question is, managing the conflict, at the same time, there are statements from various Israeli politicians about the Jordanian option. Is that a way you think it will bring Israel peace? I mean, by creating a voluntary transfer somehow, by the way it is making the lives of the Palestinians like hell, so eventually they go. That's number one. Number two, would it bring a secure Israel while you have poverty all around Israel in the area? The other point I'd like to point is that the Gaza,
Israel,
when you moved from Gaza, Israel moved from Gaza, but created at the same time 4,000 settlements in the West Bank. And not only this, you blockade Gaza in the sense that you have really helped in the success of Hamas in Gaza. And the other thing is the security fence. I can understand if it's built on the borders of 48, but we all know that it's taking on its way about 59% of the Palestinian water. It's enough of this playing games. I think I stand 100% with Mr. Bundak, and it's enough is enough. We need to move forward. Thank you.
Azadin, here, last question, please. Second row here.
Thank you.
Just state your name.
Azadin Chokri, American University in Cairo. I have a comment and a question to Ron. The comment is on the money from the Saudis and the PA and all of this. In fact, the pledges are important, and the pledges are, as usual, bigger than the money actually transferred. But this is a recurrent phenomenon in all international pledges. And the Saudis have been, if you ask Fayyad again, have been among the best in dispersing what they promised. Having said this, the point is not for the Gulf states to finance Israel's occupation or PA operations. The point I think we're talking about is whether we can get to an Arab-Israeli peace and how to do this. So I suggest, especially that there's no representatives from the Gulf, that we leave the Gulf and their money, Gulf states and their money aside. The question for you is, and I know how hard it is to be an ambassador and probably an Israeli ambassador, but you're doing a great job, and I'm not here to make a job easier.
We can analyze the Saudi plan together again.
Exactly.
We don't know.
Yeah. I think you're right about Arab states not being very eloquent in explaining their policy positions and coming up with policy statements and visions and so on. But we are not very eloquent in general. And, you know, Israel, which is a light unto the nation, is notorious for eloquence. However, I frankly haven't seen any policy statement from Israel or its leading politicians or prime ministers after the Arab Peace Initiative. The 22 Arab states put together something that is not very eloquent, I give you this. It's kind of vague, but it's a framework, as Ron said, the other Ron. It's a policy statement that is as awkward as many Arab League statements. But if you dig, you'll understand, and you talk to people, as you said. We have done this exercise a few times. But then you don't like it. Fine. Where is your policy statement on that?
Thank you. Okay. You'll have to try and answer all these questions very, very briefly, and we'll get comments from everybody else. And
first of all, I have to say that it's a joy to hear you and others in this room, and that's why I'm being very, very candid, because we have to move this thing forward. And the same way that Egypt today, what happened inside Egypt, is changing its code of conduct on certain issues, I think it's an awareness that what is happening from Iran is not just on the nuclear issue, but it changes the whole strategic environment in the Middle East. Changing the whole strategic environment in the Middle East and take Israel for a second outside of the equation, it is something that will create a series of things that then it will be completely impossible to reach something, and that is proliferation in countries thinking that also would feel that they need nuclear weapons, like Egypt, like Turkey, like Saudi Arabia. Iran is sitting on the potential oil reserves of the Western world for years to come. And just can imagine what it means when Iran has nuclear weapons and in that region, what effect it would have to each and every one of you here in Europe. And the truth of the matter that on the Iranian issue, except for governments who are doing an amazing job, and people here in the United Kingdom should be proud of what this government is doing, and other governments in Europe, also on the operational side, but there's no real sense of threat or understanding of what Iran means to the region. Leave Israel again aside completely. Israel, this thing is completely marginal. But what it means is that, and here I agree with you, Oni, that time is playing very clearly against us, and we have to rally the people and the countries that we can, who until now were not challenged. And yes, we can go into who said what, and there was a certain statement someone said, but you know that what I'm saying is true. That saying statements is not just saying statements. In Israel, it's easy to create policy papers and conduct speeches. But when you have to talk to your own people, to your own elites, and present a certain line, it's not easy. I'm not belittling it, but this is the beginning of basically building the structures that we can move on. Thank you.
A word about the fence. War. I think that I've never been in favor of it, but I think that, as the ambassador says, it proves itself as a good tool, both against terrorism and also against thefts and other activities which have never assisted cooperation and coexistence. Having said this, I think the biggest mistake of Israel is that we did the wall and the fence mostly, not mostly, but too much, within the Palestinian territories or in the West Bank. I mean, if Israel would have built the fence as it starts from the north along the Green Line, this is an Israeli prerogative within Israeli lines on the border, and everybody would have said, well, you are, it's good, it's bad, it's you are idiots, you are white, doesn't matter, but it's an Israeli sovereign decision. I think that the tragedy is that we have utilized it as a land-grabbing process. And unfortunately, it nibbles in many, many areas against security in favor of settlements. And I think this is the wrongdoing of the war in defense. So it's not the question of defense per se, but the question of the way that Israel conducted it. Secondly, is a word about the idea of the Jewish state. I personally think it was a big mistake. It is a big mistake by Netanyahu. You know, I don't know what is a Jewish state. My Judaism not necessarily corresponds with the Judaism of Agudat Israel, who are anti-Zionist, and the radical settlers in Hebron. I mean, I'm not sharing with them almost anything in Judaism. What they are doing is, I think, is anti-Zionist and in a way also anti-Jewish. So I don't know what is Jewish state. I think that we are state of Israel. They should be state of Palestine, and each state should actually self-determine itself. And we'll say that we are Jewish state, or we are Netanyahu state, or we are state of all its citizens, doesn't matter. But this is an Israeli sovereign issue. I don't need anybody, let alone the Palestinians, to assure me what I am. I am what I am, and I'm proud of what I am. Another short issue. I think, again, a word about Israel should strengthen the Palestinian side. I
think it's an Israeli interest, again, to empower the other side, like Europe is doing in its enlargement, like Europe is doing versus East Europe. Strengthening the other side is an Israeli interest. To have a poor neighbor, somebody mentioned, to have a poor neighbor is counterproductive for Israel. And there are Israelis who are working. I mean, I will not describe you all the activities of the Paris Center for Peace, which I'm the director of, but we are doing humanitarian activities, hospitalizing Palestinian, 1,000 Palestinian kids in Israeli hospital on our expense. We are doing business-to-business activities. We are now working with the Palestinian agriculture sector to export strawberries to Europe. We are working in desalinization with them, in infrastructure, in economic, and business-to-business, and you name it. And all in the name of peace, in the name of our interest to work together, and in the name of cooperation, because eventually we'll find a way to live in peace with the Palestinians, because otherwise we won't live in peace, we won't exist. And it's our interest to live and exist. And peace is a tool, it's not an objective, it's a tool for all of us. It's not that we are working for peace, living for peace. Peace should be part of our normal life.
Dr. Kamal, final statement?
About the separation of fence or wall, I'm against the wall. I think it was a populist decision under public pressure, by the Labour government, by the way, not by Ariel Sharon. I also think, and I know, that from the security point of view, it's not the most important tool. And I see the fence as a ghetto for us, the Israelis, not for the Palestinians. I feel in a ghetto, not the Palestinians. And if we speak about the fence, I don't know how many people know here, there is a fence still in Northern Ireland, in Belfast, between Catholics and Protestants. There is a fence that the Saudis built against the Shias in Yemen, on the border of Yemen. The Spain built with European financing a fence in Ceuta and Melilla not to permit the immigrants to enter the Spanish territory. But the fence in Palestine is the most important thing. I have quite, as I said, until lately at least, quite a pessimistic evaluation. I'm a very optimistic guy, but evaluation was pessimistic about the situation. I see some signs of optimism, as I said. I'd like to finish with a joke which gives some hope, because there's a joke that in Israel that a young lady is strolling on the beach, and in the sand she all of a sudden she finds a bottle, a very, very old bottle, and with great pain she opens the bottle, and a genie is going out of the bottle. So she wants to fulfill three wishes, and the genie says, "Young lady, I am so old, so tired, only one will I can fulfill." So she said, "You know, if you make peace in the Middle East, you know, all these killings, all this pain and will the suffering, I'll become famous, probably I receive the Nobel Prize, perhaps I'll be very rich, and everybody will be in peace in the Middle East." So the genius said, "You know, I'm so really very old, 2,000 years in this bottle. You have another wish." So she says, "Okay, I'm single and I want to marry, you know, but I want clearly a very, very nice guy, very well built, but he will be very rich, he will take care of the children in the kitchen, he will go to the school, that he will be very good in bed, but never, never betray me." So the genie thinks, and, "Young lady, please show me again the map of the Middle East." So there's some hope.
Just a very quick comment referring to the question about Netanyahu. Look, he is not my cup of tea. But he is now the Israeli partner. And we all have to get used to these facts that he is the Prime Minister of Israel. Now, if you analyze his first term in government, you will see that his tone was awful, was terrible. But in fact, he did withdraw from Hebron. He got out of Hebron, something Rabin and Peres before him hesitated to do. He signed the Y memorandum with Arafat, promising to deliver him 13.13% of the West Bank. And he offered Assad, senior, the Golan Heights. He was willing to travel to Damascus with a map. True, the future border on the line was to be done with a thick pen, so it would be difficult to see where to where the Israelis will withdraw. But he offered the Golan Heights. So these are the facts of life, and we have to get used to it. And as someone who is not his supporter, I can tell you that if there is any hope in the future, it's Netanyahu. Because Tzipi Livni, can't deliver. Nobody would allow her to deliver what he could deliver for the Middle East. So we should all go and vote for him again. Thank you.
First of all, it's amazing when four Israelis sit on the stage, you know, how in one line in sync we all speak. No wonder we don't need the other side to negotiate with us. We negotiate with ourselves. Which reminds me, you know, the last time that I talked to my accountant at the recent issue here, credit crunch, he told me, look, when I look at the balance book, and this is concerning the peace process, when I look at the left side of the balance sheet, nothing is right. When I look at the right side of the balance sheet, nothing is left. So I hope that we look at the balance sheet and put the relevant players that can help seriously on the front line, literally. And just a last word, what we are witnessing, I think, in the Middle East today is not a clash of civilizations, but we are witnessing a clash within a civilization in the Arab world. It is very dramatic, and because it's dramatic, this is the best opportunity for us to utilize it one way or another. And yes, please focus on Israel, but don't neglect the other children in the school. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Peter.
Well, Sefi, thank you very much. Just 2 points before we break for coffee. One, I think it's great. Whatever, Ronnie, you agree with, I think one of the great things that has come out of this discussion is that there's such a diversity of opinion in Israel. And perhaps in Britain and in Europe, we're often wrong to say Israel this, Israel that. It's actually much more complicated, much more interesting than the stereotypical view. Second thing is to thank the participant. Thank you very much.